Chapter 3, Reading 4. I was still with Jordan Baker. We were sitting at a table with a man of about my age and a rowdy little girl who gave way upon the slightest provocation to uncontrollable laughter. I was enjoying myself now. I had taken 2 finger bowls of champagne, and the scene had changed before my eyes into something significant, elemental, and profound. At a lull in the entertainment, the man looked at me and smiled.
"Your face is familiar," he said politely. "Weren't you in the 3rd Division during the war?"
"Why, yes, I was in the 9th Machine Gun Battalion."
"I was in the 7th Infantry until June 1918. I knew I'd seen you somewhere before."
We talked for a moment about some wet, grey little villages in France. Evidently, he lived in this vicinity, for he told me that he had just bought a hydroplane and was going to try it out in the morning.
"Want to go with me, old sport? Just near the shore, along the Sound."
"What time?"
"Any time that suits you best."
It was on the tip of my tongue to ask his name when Jordan looked around and smiled.
"Having a gay time now?" she inquired.
"Much better." I turned again to my new acquaintance. "This is an unusual party for me. I haven't even seen the host."
"I live over there."
I waved my hand at the invisible hedge in the distance. "And this man Gatsby sent over his chauffeur with an invitation." For a moment he looked at me as if he failed to understand.
"I'm Gatsby," he said suddenly.
"What?" I exclaimed.
"Oh, I beg your pardon."
"I thought you knew, old sport. I'm afraid I'm not a very good host." He smiled understandingly. Much more than understandingly. It was one of those rare smiles with a quality of eternal reassurance in it that you may come across 4 or 5 times in life. It faced, or seemed to face, the whole external world for an instant, and then concentrated on you with an irresistible prejudice in your favour. It understood you just so far as you wanted to be understood, believed in you as you would like to believe in yourself, and assured you that it had precisely the impression of you that, at your best, you hoped to convey. Precisely at that point, it vanished. And I was looking at an elegant young roughneck, a year or two over 30, whose elaborate formality of speech just missed being absurd. Sometime before he introduced himself, I'd got a strong impression that he was picking his words with care. Almost at the moment when Mr. Gatsby identified himself, a butler hurried toward him with the information that Chicago was calling him on the wire. He excused himself with a small bow that included each of us in turn.
"If you want anything, just ask for it, old sport," he urged me. "Excuse me, I will rejoin you later."
When he was gone, I turned immediately to Jordan, constrained to assure her of my surprise. I had expected that Mr. Gatsby would be a florid and corpulent person in his middle years.
"Who is he?" I demanded.
"Do you know?"
"He's just a man named Gatsby."
"Where is he from, I mean, and what does he do?"
"Now you're started on the subject," she answered with a wan smile.
"Well, he told me once he was an Oxford man." A dim background started to take shape behind him, but at her next remark it faded away. "However, I don't believe it."
"Why not?"
"I don't know," she insisted. "I just don't think he went there." Something in her tone reminded me of the other girl's, "I think he killed a man," and had the effect of stimulating my curiosity. I would have accepted without question the information that Gatsby sprang from the swamps of Louisiana or from the Lower East Side of New York. That was comprehensible. But young men didn't,
at least in my provincial inexperience I believe they didn't, drift coolly out of nowhere and buy a palace on Long Island Sound. Anyhow, he gives large parties, said Jordan, changing the subject with an urbane distaste for the concrete. And I like large parties. They're so intimate. At small parties, there isn't any privacy.